BlackRock has given it its blessing. They're selling call option, and that they're going to get caught short. And there's going to be basically a short squeeze that could cause like a massive Bitcoin spike. We are just getting the asset bubble warmed up. We're just getting going here. We've got 20,000 S&P. We've got 400,000 Bitcoin. We've got 5,000-6,000 gold. This is all coming by the end of the... You know, at the time I worked at Russell, I think we managed $250 billion. Anytime Bitcoin gets into five figures, you got to just buy. Because I've said since December, 150 this year, easily. But when you think about where it was, you know, 12 months ago at 50 or whatever it was before the election, you know, that's a huge move. That's a 200% move. You don't need Bitcoin to take over the world to go up 200-400%. Like, we are heading to what I think is a blow off, like eruption type parabolic move that most people have no idea.
What's up, guys? Before we get started, I've realized that over 50,000 of you guys keep coming back for every single episode. And while I'm internally grateful for you guys to keep coming back, I've realized that 79% of you guys are not subscribed. So I have one small ask before we get started. If you guys could hit that subscribe button and hit that like button to help send this interview and many more to the stratosphere, it would be greatly appreciated. All right, enough for me. Let's get into the show. Bing bong. I am back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, Mel Madison in the house for the first time, actually. But Mel, you've caught my attention by talking about the asset bubble. We've got a lot of craziness going on in the world, to say the very least, right now. So I'm curious, how do you view the overall economy, and are we in a asset bubble?
We are just getting the asset bubble warmed up. We're just getting going here. We've got 20,000 S&P. We've got 400,000 Bitcoin. We've got 5,000-6,000 gold. This is all coming by the end of the decade. And I firmly believe that. It's not sensationalism. It's not trying to, you know, talk stuff up. It's the way we're heading. And every single thing I see, whether it's Donald Trump posting about lower rates so I can, you know, reduce the deficit, like, this is like MMT type stuff that's coming from the Trump administration. It's coming from Bessent. Trump's going to be putting in his Fed chair in less than a year. Like, we are heading to what I think is a blow off, like eruption type parabolic move that most people have no idea. And we're consolidating. We're at the same level on the S&P 500 and Bitcoin as we were months ago. Like, we're just getting ready to break out. And once we do, I think it's going to take people by surprise. So we can get into all of this, why I think that's the case, why I think Iran-Israel is noise, why I think, you know, big, beautiful bill is going to be passed, why I think, you know, basically everything is lining up. And it's not about, like what could or would happen. It's about a situation that has been put in place from the fiscal situation in the United States. And that's my expertise, is really fiscal situation, that leads to no other conclusion than higher debt levels, quantitative easing, you know, lower interest rates, like yield curve control light, stable coins absorbing treasury issuance. Like, all of these things are on the horizon. They're not going to change. And whatever happens in the Middle East over, as we record this, you know, we're just getting underway with that whole shenanigan. Like, to me, that's noise. And at the end of the day, markets are going to go where markets are going to go. And it's going to be a lot higher on financial assets. And I don't like to say it, but we're not yet through this wealth inequality stage. We've got one more big boom that's going to really jack up financial assets. And I think we're going a lot higher.
Yeah. So you mentioned a lot of great things going on right now, right there. But, you know, the one thing that stood out is, like you said, you know, you think that a lot of this current situation between Iran and Israel is noise, and that Trump kind of vouching, or, you know, essentially going at Powell's neck, seriously, publicly saying, hey, we need to lower interest rates and go through quantitative easing. And then the big, beautiful bill, it seems like the perfect cocktail to make things kind of blow off the top. And, you know, I want to talk about why you think the short-term stuff is a little bit of noise and why you think the long-term, you know, we're going to be going up. So dive into that a little bit more.
Yeah. Well, what I've said, and just for people that don't know me. So I was very bearish in the end of 2024, beginning of 2025. I thought that market participants were not pricing in some of the negative aspects of Trump administration policy, whether those were tariffs, immigration raids, different aspects of it. I called it a salsa sour cream philosophy, where there was a, you know, kind of sour cream influence, meaning a cooling influence on the economy, that Doge, for example. I thought these were going to be failed, right? Like Doge was, to me, ridiculous. I study the monthly Treasury statement every single month. This is a nice 60 or so page PDF document the U.S. Treasury puts out on the eighth business day of every month at 2 p.m. And it just showed like there's no way that there's going to be a trillion or 2 trillion in cuts. If they're lucky, they're going to be able to cut, you know, 20 billion, 200 billion at the most. And then the natural rises in things like entitlements and whatever, we're going to dwarf that. And so we're going to maintain this fiscal impulse, going on. So if you look at like transfer payments, which are Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, veterans benefits, you add that with interest expense, you literally... And then you add defense, which they're increasing the Defense Department to $1 trillion budget. You're left with like $600-700 billion in truly discretionary spending. You know, like defense is considered discretionary technically, but it's not really. So how are they going to cut $1 trillion if there's like $800 billion in discretionary spending? So basically this fiscal impulse is going to continue. Now, what most people, and this is where I think I differ a little bit from, you know, the Lynn Aldens or Luke Gromans of the world, is they're looking at this and they're saying, okay, we're heading towards some sort of a fiscal collapse. Like this cannot continue. We're ready to just roll over. And what I say is there's a lot of rabbits out of the hat that central bankers can pull, whether that's pushing treasuries into stable coins, whether that's SLR reductions, you know, all of this. I've talked about all this before. We'll get into new stuff very shortly. But my main thesis has been, look, there is still a lot of room. I would not be surprised if we had a Fed balance sheet over $20 trillion by the end of the decade. I would not be surprised if debt to GDP levels in the United States get to 150, 160%. And that all of that can happen without runaway inflation. And the reason why is AI. And I think AI is a very huge deflationary impulse in this economy that is going to allow for certain measures on the fiscal end to take place. At the end of the day, this is going to mean money printing, devaluation, and it's going to mean ultimately much higher Bitcoin prices, regardless of what inflation levels are. Much higher gold prices, regardless of what inflation levels are, because you're simply going to be jacking up the money supply so much that people are going to say, hey, I want in. I want in on Bitcoin. Bitcoin's connected to the crypto economy. We've seen the Circle IPO go from priced at $30 to $250 a share. We've seen the way that things are moving, and crypto, part of institutional portfolios at BlackRock. This is just setting up for an extremely bullish situation in my mind that people are totally discounting. And as we record this today, it's 6:23. It's Monday, the day after, 30 hours after the strikes on Iran by the U.S. And everybody this weekend was thinking gold skyrockets, you know, equities down. And as we sit here today, equities are up, gold is down. So I think what people are underestimating is how short people are on the market. They're short equities. They're short Bitcoin. Bitcoin dropped to 99,000 or so over the weekend. That was a gift I was buying. The five-figure Bitcoin is going to be like a unicorn. Like it's going to, anytime Bitcoin gets into five figures, you got to just buy because it's not going to last long.
Yeah. So let's go into that, because it's always been like kind of a narrative with Bitcoin that, you know, in a uncertain economic environment, people don't really understand how it's going to react or know how it's going to react. You know, the narrative has been the digital gold, but then it's also like it's coupled with a lot of these, tech type of stocks. How do you view it in an uncertain economic environment like we're seeing right now? And I'll put you on the spot here. Do you have like a price projection or a area that you think like, hey, you know, if I were to put my money on it, like this is where I think Bitcoin is going to go, even with this short term negative price movement?
Mm, yeah. Well, I think Bitcoin is going through a transformation stage this year. So I think it entered the year as a total risk on type of an asset. Some of its performance throughout the tariff dilemmas and all of that hinted that it's starting to change its stripes a little bit. It's starting to become a little bit more shifted towards, you know, store of value. And I think, you know, just to take a step back, like that, from my perspective, this is how you have to look at things. In 1971, August 15th, you know, Nixon takes us off the gold convertibility standard. At that point, the unit of account and the currency of exchange got irreparably separated from store of value. And it just happened. Like the US dollar is simply a unit of account and a currency of exchange. It's no longer a store of value. Nobody believes it's a store of value. I mean, it's not the reserve currency anymore. Like all this talk about, oh, US is going to lose reserve currency status. We lost reserve currency status. I mean, at one point it was like 75% of foreign reserves. We now know that USD is less than 50% of foreign reserves. Second is now gold. Gold just passed the euro. And to me, what is the floor? The floor is probably like a GDP weighted level. And so if you look at US GDP as a percentage of global GDP, you're somewhere in that 25% range. I think that ultimately US dollars settle out somewhere around, you know, 25% of global reserves. We're at like 45. So we're probably going to go down another 20%, but that's really not that much considering at one point we were close to 80 and now we're under 50. So we've got a little bit more to go on kind of deleveraging the foreign holders. Foreign holders of US debt, we need to get rid of those. That is absolutely ridiculous, because what we're doing is we're paying, you know, interest payments to our enemies and our quote unquote allies. So central banks holding the dollar as reserve is not what we want going forward. What we want is U.S. Treasury debt held by U.S. institutions, U.S. banks, stable coins, the Federal Reserve. Because when you do that, any interest payments that the United States government generates essentially are just like COVID stimulus payments. And that's what we've now done. We've baked in about $1 trillion of COVID stimulus payments to the United States economy straight through via interest, what I call interest stimulus. And if you look at foreign holders of the debt, it's like less than 25% of outstanding US treasuries, which are like 36 trillion. You look at who holds it, like it's like 5 or 6 trillion on the Fed. Federal Reserve balance sheet is bigger, but they have a bunch of mortgage-backed securities. So if you actually look at US treasuries, USTs, it's like 4 or 5 billion. Okay. So that leaves $30 trillion outstanding. Where is the rest of that $30 trillion outstanding? Maybe 25% of it is foreign. We want to reduce that. We want to get it more into mutual funds, stable coins, all this stuff, so that any interest payments we're paying as a fiscal situation of the government is essentially just stimulus payments into the U.S. economy. It's going to money market funds for baby boomers so they can take their ski trips to Utah. It's going to, you know, pension funds. It's going to, you know, anybody that's going to like take this cash and just spend it. what that's going to do is just going to recycle it. And so I think what we're doing right now, we're kind of divorcing ourselves from a lot of the rest of the economy. We're divorcing ourselves from, you know, Japan. I mean, people talk about Japan or they talk about China. Oh, they own treasuries. They're going to sell treasuries. They don't own shit. Like, what does Japan own? What does China own? Like, China owns like $800 billion in treasuries. The Fed has rolled off over $2 trillion in treasuries in the last few years. Like, in 9 months, the Fed has rolled off of their balance sheet more treasuries than all of China. The Fed could absorb every single treasury China owns or Japan owns in a heartbeat. And so to talk about, like, there's some sort of power that Japan has or China has over our fiscal situation, to me, it's absolutely ridiculous. We have complete control of our fiscal situation. The U.S. dollar is still the unit of account for the world. It's still the currency of exchange for the world. It's just no longer the store of value. The store of value is now Bitcoin and it's gold. Everybody's recognizing that. And dollar is going to remain, as I said, you know, floating around the ether because of the size of the U.S. economy at 25% of global GDP. But this is nothing to be concerned about. There's no reason to worry that, oh, you know, central banks aren't going to buy our treasuries anymore, because we can just stuff them into the United States economy. And people are worried about it, but I honestly don't think that they should be. And what they're saying is like, okay, this is going to jack up long end interest rates. Okay, you know, the 10-year is going to go over 5%. The 30-year is going to go to 6. You know, fine. That's exactly what happened in the 1990s as the stock market took off, as the NASDAQ, you know, went up 200-300% in a 2-year period. The 30-year went from like 5% to 7%. So rising rates do not mean lower P's. They don't mean low risk off. They don't mean any of that. I mean, there's no correlation between, you know, treasury rates and risk on. So we have all the makings to just be massive risk on, you know, equities, financial assets, Bitcoin. The only thing I think I'm a little, I'm not bearish on, but I'm not very bullish on is real estate, because I think there is a push behind the government to make real estate more affordable. And so I wouldn't be like buying homes right now, but as far as Bitcoin, gold, equities, I think they're all, you know, up and to the right for as far as the eye can see.
Well, what does that mean? You didn't give me the Bitcoin price prediction, Mel. I got to put you on the spot here because, I mean, you know, it definitely seems like everybody's super bullish and that Bitcoin is starting to take money away from these major markets, as in, like, you know, the bond market and everything else. And it seems to be that store of value. So what we're seeing now is that central banks are, you know, have been either flocking towards gold for years, or, you know, there's rumblings of central banks looking at Bitcoin, even, you know, the United States even potentially looking at Bitcoin as a strategic reserve. So, you know, where do you take that into account? Is that almost the United States recognizing, hey, there's some weakness here in the dollar because of the amount of, you know, spending that we've had? So we need to get Bitcoin as that kind of hedge against that for ourselves? Or, you know, how do you see the government and potentially being involved in this as a factor of Bitcoin going forward?
Yeah. Well, I think 150 is like in the cards for this year. That's what I said in December. I stick with that. I'm going to reevaluate it, and I'll give you a little details on where that 150 comes from and why I think that's the level. And I also think that this level we got to this weekend around 100 is now like the floor. So, like, that's why I was buying this weekend when we got to 99. Because, like, to me, that's rarity. Like, we're, you know, seeing five figure Bitcoin is like seeing, I don't know, an albatross. Like, it's just like, if it gets to five figures, just buy it. like, you know, don't even think about it. Don't worry about what's happening in politics. If Bitcoin's in five figures, buy it. It got into five figures this weekend. I bought it. Right now I'm looking, it's 102,425 on my screen at 10:31 on 6/23. And, you know, so I'm up a few thousand. I think it's going to, you know, this is where you get in. But basically, if we look at where is those price levels coming from, so I like to look at monthly charts of Bitcoin. I like to look at where it closed, where it dropped to. When I look at what was like the 2021 monthly high, and it's been a while since I've repeated these numbers, so these numbers might not be perfect, but it was something in the 60s in 2021. Dropped to something around 17,000 on a monthly close. I do know this number is correct. From the monthly close high in 21 to the monthly close low in 22, it was a $44,000 decline. When you look at a chart and you look at like a bowl, we went from that 69 or whatever it was down to 16 or 17, and it was a 44,000 decline. Once we got back there, adding 44,000, which is the spread of the bowl, to the previous high got you to 106. And so in 2024, I said my call on Bitcoin is 106. I believe we got to around 108. So I was a little light on that. But the thing with Bitcoin, because it trades 24/7, people calculate daily ranges differently. You know, you got Bitstamp, Coinbase, BTC futures. Like it's a guessing game a little bit on what's the proper, you know, technical level to look at. So I looked at those levels. I came to 106. That was a $44,000 bowl. I added 44,000 to that 106, and I got to 150. So I've said since December, 150 this year easily. And I think a lot of people, you know, might be disappointed in that and say, oh, well, that's not that much. But when you think about where it was, you know, 12 months ago at 50 or whatever it was before the election, you know, that's a huge move. That's a 200% move. So I wouldn't be disappointed with a 150 call. I think that we could get to 150 sooner rather than later. And then I would add another 44,000 kind of bowl on top of that, which gets me to 194,000. So, like, could we get to 194,000 by the end of the year? Sure. I will relook at things and how the situation is once we get to 150. But right now, my call is like 150 by the end of the year. And, you know, like I said, it's not been straight up, and there's been pullbacks and there's been consolidation periods, but that's a part of Bitcoin maturing as an asset. As it gets bigger, as it becomes worth trillions of dollars, it's not going to necessarily double every 6 months. So people shouldn't, you know, expect that. That does not mean that over the long run, it can't outpace every single investment, which is what I also have said, which is if I was to look at S&P 500, a global equity index, gold, what do I think is the best performing asset over the next 5 to 10 years? It's Bitcoin. Will Bitcoin perhaps have a little more volatility than those assets? Maybe. But I do think that it gets there. And so 150 is my next target. Probably we'll raise that to 194 once we get there. And I think that's only a matter of time, because we're just seeing crypto, you know, just totally emerge into my background. Like, for people that don't know me, I do have a TradFi background. I have an MBA from Duke. I served as the CEO of three different FINRA broker dealers. I worked for asset managers like Russell Investments that, you know, maintain the Russell 2000 index, things like that, based out of Seattle. So I've spent time working for, you know, at the time I worked at Russell, I think we managed $250 billion, like big asset managers, different people. So what I see happening is that Bitcoin is just beginning to enter that. And it's entering it, you know, actually much more slowly than a lot of people might expect, because they're cautious. Like, they're like, oh, there's volatility and whatever. But over time, it's going to become accepted. It's going to move into the model portfolios of every financial advisor around the country and then around the world. It's just going to be part of a sleeve in your asset management portfolio. Larry Fink has basically ordained this. BlackRock has given it its blessing. As this happens, you know, $2 trillion market cap. We're in the between two and three right now. I mean, that's nothing. I mean, it's easily going to go up. So you don't need Bitcoin to take over the world to go up 200, 300, 400%. You just need it to become incorporated into these model portfolios. And it is becoming incorporated. And so, like, that's just part of it. Like, Bitcoin is a long arc. It's not a short arc. It's not like, you know, and I will say there is always that tail risk potential, though, for a massive spike. There's a guy, Jordy Visser, you might know of. He talks about, he thinks a lot of people that own Bitcoin, what they're doing is they're going out because of the volatility on IBIT, the BlackRock ETF. They're selling call options and that they're going to get caught short. And there's going to be basically a short squeeze that could cause like a massive Bitcoin spike. I think that's totally possible. That could jack Bitcoin to like 200,000 in like a matter of months. So we've got those types of things out there, but even if they don't happen, I still think the long-term trajectory with Circle, the passage of the Genius Act, which it's passed through the Senate, but it's got bipartisan support. It's going to get through, right? I mean, Trump has tweeted, oh, pass the Genius, like crypto is becoming part of the traditional finance structure of the globe in a way that people could never expect it to be even 5 or 10 years ago, maybe even a year ago before Trump got elected. And so what, and the last thing I'll add is whether we have a strategic Bitcoin reserve or not, doesn't matter to me, because there were people in 1971, when the US was going off the gold standard, saying the gold price is gonna collapse because the US isn't backing it anymore. And instead the gold price went up over 20X. It went from $35 an ounce to over $800 an ounce and went up 22, 23X. In a 10-year period, even though it was divorced from the monetary establishment. And so I've always said, I don't think that Bitcoin becoming part of the monetary establishment is anything to do with the bull case. And in fact, the less it becomes part of the monetary establishment, perhaps the more bullish you should be on Bitcoin, because the government, once they get involved, who knows what they do. But what we do know is that they're going to be printing, they're going to be spending money, we've got out of control entitlements, we know all of that, and that's very bullish Bitcoin.
The best place to buy Bitcoin in the United States and Canada is the Bitcoin Well. You could go to the bitcoinwell.com/greencandle and sign up today, and they will give you wishing well tokens. They are one of the only exchanges in the United States that will give you free sats every time you buy Bitcoin. You have a chance to win 1 million sats every time you buy. You get wishing well tokens, you flip the coin down the wishing well, and you have the chance to win 1 million sats. You heard me here, folks, 1 million sats. And on top of that, they have the absolute best over-the-counter service where you can make purchases over $50,000, and they will walk you through the whole thing. They have the best rates in the United States and in Canada. And on top of that, they have the best white glove service where they will take you through those giant purchases just so you feel comfortable. You'll get it in cold storage and it's strictly non-custodial. They are saying, we want you to experience the true power of Bitcoin and that self-custody. So go to the well, sign up, bitcoinwell.com/greencandle today.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like, you know, I'm getting hyped up over here, extremely bullish with everything going on, especially, you know, you're saying the chance of a supply squeeze here because of what we're seeing. And I think the unique aspect too, I mean, you know, we're seeing a lot of corporations start to back, you know, Bitcoin and put it on the balance sheet. Yeah, we got Michael Saylor and Strategy B buying Bitcoin literally every single week. So I think just the fundamentals from that aspect are starting to, you know, ramp up. But I'm curious because, you know, we definitely have had the narrative in the traditional financial world that, you know, all right, these ETFs are going to change everything. But it seems like the ETFs are mostly retail at this point, and that the traditional financial world hasn't necessarily caught up to Bitcoin. We've got Larry Fink maybe giving the blessing. We've got a few others maybe potentially saying, hey, put 1-2% of your portfolio in there. But, you know, what is it going to take for traditional finance to get in on Bitcoin? And, you know, do you think that ever is going to happen?
No, I definitely think it's going to happen. And this was actually part of my job at Russell Investments. Like, we managed about $250 billion. I worked there 2010 to 2013, right after I graduated from my Duke MBA. And I worked in what we call PCS, Private Client Services, which was our mutual fund division. It was about $50 billion. So, you know, not that big. But we had these model portfolios, and Russell Investments still has these modern model portfolios. And every year we would go through and we would think, how do we want to allocate these? You know, what do we want to allocate to international developed, EM, US large cap, US small cap, you know, bonds, alts. You know, we had a infrastructure fund when I worked there. We had a commodity fund. So we're trying to create, where does all this $50 billion go? And almost nobody has put it in there. I think on BlackRock, they have a portfolio. They have a set of modern model portfolios that include a significant alternative investment allocation. And in that portfolio, BlackRock has included Bitcoin. They've yet to include it in their standard model portfolios. And then there's a bunch of companies, Russell, Morgan Stanley, like JP Morgan, that have, you know, not even done it. And the reason why, I think, you know, this goes back to other things that I've talked about for a long time, is like the threat that cryptocurrency poses to the banking system. And I think, and this is not the most libertarian view, but I think this is what's happening, is Genius Act is laying the groundwork for stable coins. Cynthia Lummis, I've listened to her back in December. She was doing interviews and she was saying there's three, you know, phases to this. The first is we're going to pass the Genius Act. That's going to be a bipartisan bill to get stable coins, you know, regulated. The next thing is the market regulation of crypto. That's the next big thing. And then the third thing is, once we have the Genius Act and, you know, clarity on where's Bitcoin live, is it a commodity, a security, a currency, CFTC, SEC. Once we get through all of that, the third phase is going to be creation of the strategic, you know, crypto reserve, if you will. And so we're only in the first stage, and we haven't even passed the Genius Act yet into law. We've, you know, it's gone through. So all these things are going to be happening in the next 12 to 18 months, and they're all going to be positive, you know, Bitcoin, crypto. I was buying Circle, you know, on the day of the IPO. I was like, you know, I bought eTor too. So I there's a couple of crypto ETFs, or excuse me, IPOs in the last month, eTor and the Israeli company, and Circle. And I bought both of them on the day they came out. Circle, I bought at like $98, I think was my cost basis. I sold a little bit of Circle for the first time on Friday, actually, at like $240 a share. I think it's still up as we're talking. Oh my God, Circle's at 275. I mean, it was 240 on Friday. Dude, this is ridiculous. I sent out a post like 2 or 3 weeks before Circle IPO'd. And I was like, stable coins are going to be bigger than anybody really knows. And I talked about shorting Visa. Let me see what Visa is doing today, because I have puts on Visa. It's flat. Okay. So basically I was like, look, this is just too good. I mean, anybody that's got a wallet and actually done transactions, I was talking to my mother. My mother actually trades stocks and options. She was born in 1943. She's like 81 or 82 years old. And she's like, why is Circle going up so much? Because I told her to buy Circle. And I'm like, Mom, this is just, you don't understand. You've never done a transaction with your own wallet. Like, you've never done it. I remember the first time I did a transaction with my own wallet and I'm sending money and sending it to somebody and somebody sending me. And, you know, I'm like, there's nobody involved in this. There's no Visa. There's no bank. There's nobody doing this. And it was USDC. It was like somebody was sending me $20 to buy a copy of my book Quaz. And I'm like, I'll send it to you. Just send it to my wallet. And that was the first transaction I ever did with my own wallet. And I admittedly, I've been late to this. Like the first time I heard about Bitcoin was 2012. I was driving in my car in Seattle, heading to Russell Investments to work at like 7:30 in the morning. And NPR was doing a story about this new thing called Bitcoin. And I'm listening to it and I'm like, wow, that sounds interesting. Because I've always been like a precious metal guy. I've always seen this, like the fiat is just getting out of control. So I started buying, you know, gold and silver like long time. In fact, I've got this microphone and I literally have it sitting on a 100-ounce bar of silver. And I literally bought this for like 10 bucks an ounce, you know, whatever it is. Okay, it's up 367 today, whatever. Doesn't matter. You know, this is worth like what, $3,700 now, whatever. Paid like 1,400. I have it there. I have my phone sitting up on a, I like collectible coins too. This is like a 10-ounce Elizabeth. You know, anyway, and this goes back like long before Bitcoin ever existed, right? I've always been like, look, dollars are just, they're a unit of account and a transaction currency. That's all they are. Starting in 1971, there is absolutely zero store of value function in the USD. It's precious metals, and then it became Bitcoin. In 2012, I hear about Bitcoin, and I think to myself, this sounds amazing. I want to buy some. This is before Coinbase, all this stuff. I go home, and I'm trying to figure out, and I start researching it. And I literally am searching and I'm like, you got to go onto this thing called Silk Road. And then they're talking about, okay, what you need to do is like you download, like it was a type of a browser that it did not have, like, I don't know, it was early version of a VPN. I have no idea what it was. I'm not a technical guy. I was trying to do all this for hours, trying to buy Bitcoin in 2012. I couldn't do it. Biggest mistake in my life, right? like I gave up on it. I literally said, screw it. I don't know. Then like a few years later, I had friends calling me because I'm like the finance guy friend. What do you think about this Bitcoin? It's up to like 2000, you know, it sounds good. And I'm like, I don't know, man, because I'm remembering it when it was like $100 or whatever. I'm thinking that's up a lot. It took me until the first time I bought a Bitcoin, I bought it at $11,000 a coin. And I was like thinking, this is ridiculous, you know? And now I'm just like, man, 100,000 is a gift. And that's what happens to Bitcoin. Bitcoin finds you. Like you go through this process. Had I not given up on it, had I said, you know what, this is really something I want to stick with, I, you know, Lord knows how much I'd be worth right now. I probably would have sold it when it went up 10X. But, you know, it's like this is Bitcoin and it keeps doing it. And it keeps doing it and doing it and doing it. And it's not going to stop. And then it's going to be $1 million. And people are going to say, damn, I should have bought it when it was 100.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't think like traditional finance is really just like, you know, come around to that fact strictly because it's unlike anything we've really seen. You know, you were holding up the silver bars and the coins, and I thought that was absolutely electric. But, you know, the reality is there's always, you know, the Winklevoss twins were telling Dave Portnoy, hey, Elon's going to mine gold off of asteroids and crazy things. So I don't know if we've really been able to comprehend the true scarcity of Bitcoin. And there hasn't really been a financial asset like we've seen before. And on top of that, now that we're putting companies are putting it on the balance sheet, you know, at least the Bitcoin community is talking about, you know, MNAV and all of these different metrics on how to calculate the actual value of these Bitcoin corporations with like MSTR strategy and all these other ones popping up, Nakamoto 21 with Jack Mallers. Do you think that, you know, traditional finance is like almost going to dip their toe in with some of these treasury companies? And do you think that they've even figured out a way on how to evaluate companies putting Bitcoin on their balance sheet?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they're late, but they're going to get to it. And I think a lot of it is a little bit of a generational thing. I consider myself kind of in a bridge generation. I'm a Gen X guy. I was born in 1975. I'm solidly Gen X. I'm not a boomer. I'm not a millennial. I think I've seen things coming earlier than the boomers and later than the millennials. And so, like, I feel like my generation now is starting to get it to be into charge. I think obviously this is probably going to be the last time we have a boomer president, and who knows, maybe we don't even have a Gen X. Well, I guess Obama was technically Gen X, but like there's a big shift going on. And I think once that shift happens, and that's actually the biggest risk I do see to Bitcoin. So I love Bitcoin. I see everything about it and what it does. And I think the only big risk that I see to Bitcoin ever, and it's hegemony in the crypto world, is that as that founding generation starts to pass away, and this is going to be a long time, right? This is going to be 30, 40, 50 years from now, probably after we're dead. Do people start to say, wait a minute, we could maybe do something different. We could create another one, right? We like, why do we want this one? And like, to me, what Bitcoin has, right? And I'm not a technical expert, right? But it's got the network, it's got the nodes, it's got the history, it's got the use cases, it's got everything. But at the end of the day, if you're intellectually honest, there could be a point where in 80 years, a generation says, wait a minute, these people created Bitcoin, it became the center of the world, but we want to create something new. And, you know, so, you know, I know I'm on a Bitcoin podcast, but I have to admit, like, that how can you argue against it, right, Brandon? I mean, could there be a generational shift in value appreciation of crypto assets that shifts to something new? Is it possible? Maybe. But the network effects, the more Bitcoin gets embedded, the less and less likely that becomes. There was a guy, it's out of Puerto Rico, I think, Pantera Capital, guy who bought a bunch of Bitcoin. You might know his name. And he used to say, he'd come on CNBC, he'd say, the biggest risk I see is Bitcoin is there's like some sort of a chance that maybe in regulatory worlds or whatever, it goes to zero. But I no longer see that now. Like, Bitcoin is it. And I do see Bitcoin as it, right? And so I do think, like, this whole thing is just getting started. It's early innings. And I honestly think if there's any threat to Bitcoin, it's post my lifespan. You know, like, I don't see a Bitcoin, like, in 2300. I don't know. But am I worried about what's going to happen in 2300? You know, like, does the new generation say, you know what, all this Bitcoin's here, and we're going to restart a token, and there's a Satoshi Nakamoto 2.0 that comes out. I don't know. So I don't want to act like there's absolutely no reason why. But here's the thing. Like, you look at gold, right? Gold could have easily been replaced. Platinum is more rare than gold. You know, you've got other precious metals like palladium that have a lot of use cases in catalytic converters. But throughout history, there's been something about gold. And I think Bitcoin has that same thing. It's got that gold aura. It's not going to lose that anytime soon, where people say, no, we're going to start valuing another crypto as the baseline. And so to me, I think you make that bet. And that's why I make that bet time and time again, is like, you know, you make that bet that Bitcoin is it. Bitcoin is the gold standard of crypto. And it's not going to be displaced anytime soon. And because of that, you go with it. And, you know, yeah, it's, I can't back it up more than that. I can't say, oh, there's no reason why that can't happen. There's no good reason. But there's also no good reason why gold doesn't get replaced by palladium, or gold doesn't get replaced by platinum, right? Central banks don't buy platinum. Why? Platinum is actually more rare in the earth. It's useful in many devices. Like, in some sense, platinum is a better metal than gold. Platinum, when I was younger, platinum was much more expensive than gold, right? Platinum's at like $1,200 an ounce and gold's at $3,500 because gold is gold. And I think Bitcoin is Bitcoin. And you're not going to replace that anytime soon.
Okay, so you've discovered Bitcoin and are on the path to financial self-sovereignty. But simply holding Bitcoin is not enough. You need to make sure that it's stored properly and you are in 100% control over all your assets. So sharing your keys with third parties and taking on that counterparty risk is not the answer. The answer is pure and simple. It's uncompromising self-custody, and there's no better way to do it than the Bitcoin way. They've got over 25 years of cybersecurity experience, and their team of experts can help you properly self-custody your Bitcoin, secure your digital life, configure your privacy phones, and even establish a Plan B residency if you're looking to do so. So I'm going to help you guys out here and give you a free consultation if you take the first step and visit thebitcoinway.com/greencandle, and you can check out the boys at The Bitcoin Way and see how they can help you become self-sovereign.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that, you know, when it comes to like other cryptocurrencies, we're going to always see, you know, there's such low a barrier to entry, to be honest. So like, you know, Mel, you and I right now, we can go look up some code or maybe hire a dev or something like that and create a token based on this conversation we're having right here. But the unique aspect of Bitcoin is that, you know, it's truly decentralized and that the founder stepped away. The reason why I think that there's maybe not going to be another Bitcoin type, just strictly because of human greed and ego at this point. Like every other cryptocurrency that we've seen has some sort of marketing department, right? Bitcoin's kind of been like a word of mouth type of thing. You know, you and I are sitting here talking about it. Nobody really knows who Satoshi is. And maybe I'm wrong. You know, and maybe there's somebody like that comes down in the future and improves Bitcoin. But I think just as it stands right now, people are just really going to be going towards the, you know, the true trusted, you know, cryptocurrency of sorts. And I don't know if we'll necessarily see that ever again, at least in my lifetime. But it's not a 0% chance, right? I mean, with Bitcoin, if you were to tell me somebody were to create digital scarcity, and then, you know, Bitcoin goes from literally less than a penny to over $100,000. And the founder had a million Bitcoin in their wallet and just strictly walked away. And now it's worth, you know, billions of dollars. I would have told you that's absolutely insane. And that founder or whatever would have, you know, trimmed some off the top, to say the very least. But, you know, I think that's a conversation for another time. I want to dive.
It's not even incredible. It's unbelievable. It's not even once in a lifetime type stuff. I mean, if I took in a few thousand dollars when I first heard of Bitcoin, I mean, I would be worth hundreds of millions of this. Like, this is ridiculous. This just does not happen. There's no other asset. There's nothing like it. It is unique. It is once not in a lifetime. It's like once in a millennium. It's like being there at the founding of gold. It's to be born. We don't realize what it means to be born during the advent of crypto, of Bitcoin. Like this is a moment that is, you know, historical. And we're living through it and we don't understand how special it is. And I do think people will look back in 50, 60 years and there'll be some 20-year-old in 2050 that's like, oh my God, I honestly can't believe that Bitcoin was ever trading at under a dollar. Like, just, I can't believe that. Can't believe somebody paid 10,000 Bitcoin for a pizza. They won't believe it. They'll think it's conspiracy theory.
Yeah, exactly. It's incredible. And I mean, like you said, right? I mean, we've seen just Bitcoin absolutely explode. I mean, I did a video not too long ago about, you know, why I think 0.01 or, you know, a tenth of or 1% of a Bitcoin is the new millionaire class, because there's 59 million millionaires in the world right now as it stands. 13 million public wallets have, and all wallets are public, but, you know, maybe ETF, something else, have 1% of a Bitcoin. And so, you know, it's more rare to be in that class right now with just like $1,000 worth. And that, you know, around the time you heard about Bitcoin If you bought Bitcoin, I believe it's in January of 2013 at the time of this recording, you that $1,000 worth of Bitcoin then would be worth $1 million today. So, I mean, that amount of price appreciation in 12 years is incredible. I mean, you just can't.
There's nothing else.
There's no better.
I can't look at crude. I can't look at gold. I can't look at anything. I can't look at real. I can't look at California beachfront real estate. And it's not even close. Like as a financial guy, when I look at the returns on Bitcoin and I think that I knew about it in 2012 and did not buy it and hold it, the only thing that lets me sleep at night is that I saw a tweet once. It was like, you know, something about true Bitcoin believers. And they're like, the smartest guys, if they had bought Bitcoin back then, they'd probably have sold it when it was up 10x or something. And I just feel like I would have done that. Like I never try to claim to be like a Bitcoin OG holder dude. Like I'm a TradFi guy. I knew about it. Had I bought it when it was $100 or $1,000, I probably would have sold it when it got to 10. Like I never started really believing in it until I would say COVID. And what happened during COVID was I took some time off. I wrote a novel called Quaz. It's called Quantum Oz. It's about, you know, like AI and quantum computers taking over financial markets and corrupt central bankers putting in a blockchain-based, you know, global digital currency. And I started really digging into the fiscal situation of the United States. And I started looking at, you know, how much of our money, you know, is going towards healthcare, towards Social Security, veterans benefits, defense, and the trajectory that it's been on. And I just said, like, this is going to get out of hand. Like, it reminds me of, I don't know what it is, Hunt for Red October, maybe. You know, Jack Ryan is on an aircraft carrier and there's some admiral there and some fighter jet, you know, crashes into something. And he looks at Jack Ryan. He's like, if we don't get this sorted out, because they're all hunting for Red October, you know, this is going to get out of hand and it's going to get out of hand quick. And it's like, I'm looking at stuff and I'm like, this is going to get out of hand. Like, this is not, there is no way to like cut spending and like we need a complete divorce of, and this needs to be accepted by everybody, what I've been saying all throughout our discussion, is we need a complete divorce of the USD as a store of value. It's just a currency. It's a medium of exchange and a unit of account. It has absolutely no store of value function. And people need to understand that. They need to know that, like, the Fed balance sheet could go to $20 trillion, that a home that costs $500,000 now could cost $2.5 million in 30 years, that, like, the USD is, it's going to be printed. You know, we got Iran news these days. It's interesting that in the 1960s and 70s, they actually had $20 bill printing plates stationed in the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. Why did they do that? So the CIA could handle all of their Asian operations with as much cash as they wanted, right? Like, the dollar is very functional as a fiat currency. It's very functional to be able to print as much as you want to print. Like, to be able to put a printing press in a Tehran embassy and print as many $20 bills as you want to fund as many, you know, government regime change overthrows as you want, this is very functional, right? So there is a use case for fiat, believe it or not. And what I think is that, like, fiat, people are starting to understand this. They're incorporating it. They're internalizing it. And they're getting to the point where they understand that there is no store of value function in USD, period. Don't think about it that way. And US treasuries are not keeping up with it. And the only way you maintain purchasing power is Bitcoin, gold, maybe equities as well, and other appreciating assets, because USD is just, you know, it's flypaper. It's nothing. It's toilet paper. I mean, it doesn't matter anymore. It's not what it was in 1970. It's not even what it was in 1930. And to be honest with you, it's not what it was ever, right? I mean, like, people talk about, oh, U.S. currencies. Man, the first government ever to print a truly fiat currency with no backing by precious metals was the colony of Virginia in the 1700s. And they printed what they called, essentially, they created these pieces of paper that they sent out into the economy. And they said that these pieces of paper could be used to pay taxes. And this is now starting to get into MMT, which is modern monetary theory, and the basis of currency value. Currency has value because it's useful to pay taxes. Taxes need to be paid. Taxes are enforced through violence and state force. As long as there are trillions of dollars of taxes that are required to be paid to the federal government in USD, there will be a function for USD. That doesn't mean it's a store of value. And so we've moved from a store of value world where we start to look at fiat as store of value. Bitcoiners have known this for a long time. I've known it for 20 years when I started buying these silver bars. That whole store of value thing is gone. And it's going in one direction. And any of these blips on the screen of, oh, Bitcoin's down to 99,000 because Trump sent some bombs to Israel or Iran, which, by the way, I also think is ridiculous, because it's like, this is, you know, I don't want to downplay it, but I said I'm more scared of the I-95 than I am of the IRGC, which is like there's 1.35 million people every year that die in automobile accidents. How many people die in war violence? Almost nobody. And so war and violence, it gets the headlines. Last thing I'll say, I know I'm rambling on here, but I turned on yesterday, they had a CNBC special report at 7 o'clock, I think it came on, because of the bombing. And they were totally expecting like futures to be down and the stock market to be collapsing. And they had this deep voice person do an intro, and they showed, you know, B-2 bombers. And it was just total war scare propaganda. And it's like, what does that have to do with Meta earnings? Like, what does that have to do with the AI transformation? Like, don't you know we've been involved in Middle East wars for the last 50 years? Like, why do you think that's going to affect S&P earnings? And why? And the market's finally starting to realize this. Like, a few years ago, probably, you know, we'd be down, you know, 1-3% on the S&P right now after what happened this weekend as we record. And instead, I'm looking, S&P is, you know, it's up. You know, SPX is trading at 59.98, up 30 points, up 0.5% on Monday after the initial Trump bombing of Iran. Nobody would have thought that, you know, 48 hours ago. And so we are in a new world. And if you start playing along to the playbook of, oh, well, you know, we've got big fiscal deficits and we're not going to be able to handle it. No, we're going to be able to handle it. And the way we're going to handle it is we're going to put it on the Fed balance sheet. We're going to stuff it into stable coins. Like, USD is a illusion. It's a machination. It's a hallucination. It can be manipulated into any form you want. And you just recognize, like, that's the situation in the world we're living in, and that's going to drive up financial asset prices, including equities, gold, and Bitcoin.
Yeah, and it definitely seems like that's going to be the flock, right? It's like people are going to start to flock to gold and Bitcoin as a kind of like a safe haven. But, you know, you mentioned the asset bubble, and you think it's kind of getting started. And we talked a little bit about it at the beginning of this conversation. I want to get back to that a little bit, because, you know, I think it's kind of peculiar where we're seeing, you know, Trump essentially going at Jerome Powell publicly and looking for the traditional, you know, or the for quantitative easing to start occurring. Obviously, that would, you know, equate to higher asset prices. But, you know, do you see the overall economy with this $37 trillion worth of debt that we just started almost out on like a house of cards where, you know, we could see that the total collapse of the fiat currency and, you know, assets just skyrocket up. And then, you know, the average Joe who holds no assets essentially be left out to dry.
Yeah. Well, I think that's probably the most important thing to talk about, because I think a lot of people think that the Trump administration is going to address wealth inequality. I think it's going to get worse. I think we're heading for one more really big parabolic move of financial assets, equities, Bitcoin, like gold. What happens after that? I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it's going to be a collapse or it's going to be, you know, something that's a little more subtle. But I think a lot of people have seen the wealth inequality gap. They've seen the rise in home prices. They've seen the rise in financial assets. And they said this has to stop. And I think that they're underestimating that we're actually heading into a bigger expansion of those discrepancies. And let me explain why. I think that AI is going to truly be a deflationary force. This deflationary force is going to lead to layoffs. And these layoffs are going to lead to massive government spending, transfer payments, low interest rates, all of it. And it's not going to necessarily be inflationary because of the deflationary aspects of AI. And so what we're going to do is we are going to blow out M2. Like I've said, Fed balance sheet, $20 trillion by the end of the 2030s. Government debt to GDP. We're heading into a Japan-type scenario, right? Japan has like 240% debt to GDP. We're at 120. So we're just getting started. And I think we're heading down that road. And what it's going to do is it's going to allow companies, and again, I think I mentioned him earlier, Jordy Visser, who I listened to a lot about AI and its impact on the markets, you know, and he shows charts of like, okay, Microsoft's going to lay off people. He shows Mag7 earnings, like up 20% and headcount flat or down. And so this is an equity price driver. It's a BTC driver. It's essentially heading into a position where, and I think ultimately the solution is actually going to be beneficial, ultimately, but it's going to not be that happy to get there. Ultimately, I think it's going to lead to things like a 4-day work week, a 30-hour work week. It's going to lead to, high transfer payments actually being able to be continued, so that people are actually still going to be able to get their Social Security. Most people say, oh, Social Security, yeah. So I'm totally contrarian on all of this, but I actually think that the capacity of the United States economy, especially once it begins taking away this dependence on foreign holders of treasuries and it starts putting it into stable coins and bank balance sheets, that we're going to be able to do things just as in 2007, when the Fed balance sheet was $700-800 billion, and it got to $9 trillion at the end of COVID. Anybody tell you that the Fed balance sheet is going to go up 1,000% in, you know, like a decade or so, they'd look at you as like you're crazy. Well, 1,000% increase of the Fed balance sheet from its recent high of $9 trillion is $90 trillion. So if we're going to go to a Fed balance sheet of $90-100 trillion in the next 10 to 15 years, because the USD is now almost an autarkic currency, and autarky is like a state that's like completely self-contained. If we get like an autarkic currency with USD, where it doesn't matter if Japan buys our treasury debts anymore, we're going to be printing so much. And the reason we're going to be able to do this is going to be because of AI. And this is going to exaggerate this financial discrepancy. But I do think that it has the potential, unlike what happened in, say, 2022, where we had high inflation, real wages going down. We could have real wages increase, but the rich get even richer. And so this is totally unpopular. This is like 80s type stuff, trickle down economics, Reagan. Like, the rich are going to get richer, financial assets are going to get higher, but that lower 50% is actually going to get into a better situation. And so this, I don't know many people that are talking about this. They're all talking about, we're either going towards, okay, a financial collapse and it's horrible, or we're going to, you know, narrow the gap. What I'm saying is the gap's going to expand between the rich and the poor, but the, and poor is not the right word. Let's say the rich and the not so rich, and the not so rich are actually going to go up in their standard of living. And we're going to have a massive debasement, and we're going to have a massive asset bubble. And this is why, you know, I think like we have at least one more big wave, whether you want to call it an Elliott wave or whatever, a blow off top. I'll reassess it in 2027. But I think what we're heading towards right now is a massive expansion, because markets are going to start to realize companies can lay people off or not hire and keep their margins, their profit levels. That's going to increase multiples. There's going to be multiple expansion, earnings expansion. They're going to look at Bitcoin. They're going to say the government's going to be printing. Trump's going to put in a Fed chair in less than a year. That's going to be very dovish. Like, all of these things are starting to build up. And I think the market's starting to glimpse it. And I think that's why you've got, you know, the S&P up on a day after the United States essentially, you know, instigates bombings in the Middle East.
Self-custody can be a daunting task. That's why I've partnered with Bitbox. They have the best hardware wallet. They make it the easiest to put Bitcoin in self-custody. So go to bitbox.swiss/greencandle today and use promo code greencandle, and you can get 5% off your entire order. They make it so easy, all in one. You could get the hardware wallet, you could get their punch plates, you could do it all right there on that website to make the self-custody experience the easiest it can be. So visit bitbox.swiss/greencandle, use promo code greencandle, get 5% off your entire order, and get your Bitcoin off an exchange into self-custody today. All right, enough from me. Let's get back to the show.
Yeah, so that is very interesting that you think that, you know, that this gap is, you know, essentially going to increase, and, you know, that the widening between the two parties, because, you know, I think everybody kind of thought that the Trump economy would fix all, and it would be kind of the end all be all. But do you think that, what was the, I guess, alternative to this? Do you think that this is kind of the only way out, and it's just going to kind of start the spiral that's going to end the potential? Because, I mean, you're saying, right, the USD is no longer a store of value, right? It's just simply a unit of account and a medium of an exchange. Do you ever see like the US dollar kind of waning and losing that status as well?
Well, like I said, I don't think it's a reserve currency anymore. I think central banks around the world aren't adding, and I think they're declining. And so I think that's all done. I think it's all baked in the cake. So, I mean, I don't think there's anything to worry about losing reserve status. I think we've already lost it. Like, so this is like the Elis and the Warlocks. These are the two creatures in H.G. Wells' novel about the future, where human beings as a species separate into two different species. And there's one species, and they're very peaceful. And they live above ground. If you've never read, I don't know what the name of it is. I forget the name of the novel, but I read it when I was like in high school. So it's been a long time, but like all these humans live on the surface, and it seems like a very peaceful existence. But underneath the caves, there's this subspecies of humans that are like, you know, I don't know. I think they're carnivores or something, but they come up at night and they kill the humans on the top and eat them or something like that. And that essentially humanity separates into two different levels. And I think, you know, again, I think it's the third time I'll do it, but there was a Jordi Visser video last week. He was talking about Schumpeter, which is an economist. And he was talking about, you know, capital, capitalism leads to these types of outcomes where technology becomes so efficient because of capitalism that labor becomes less and less important. And so there was a time not long ago where pretty much any man could do what any other man did. And there was like almost like an equilibrium. And we're getting to a point now with AI and PhD level intelligence and maybe, AGI and all these things. That's really kind of a transformative stage. And financial markets are just beginning to understand this. Like, you know, CNBC people might be talking about some of these topics in like 2 years. Because like nobody's going to come on and say this if they work for Morgan Stanley, because, you know, they'll probably be fired. Like these ideas are not mainstream yet, but they eventually will be, just like 2 years ago when I was worrying about deficits, like, you know, and then it becomes, you know, what people talk about. And this is what's amazing about, you know, podcasts like yours or YouTube. This is now where the global town square, the innovative ideas come out. They don't come out on MSNBC anymore. They come out on Green Candle. So this is where the reality, the edge of thinking is. And eventually, you know, the rest catch up. But I think that this is actually where we're heading. And you know, it's not going to be everything I said is right and I know everything, because I'm going to be wrong about a bunch of this. But some combination of what I'm saying is going to be right, some combination of what other top thinkers out there are saying is going to be right. And it's going to amalgamate into a new reality that's very different from what you're getting listening to a Credit Suisse private wealth manager analyst on Bloomberg talking about, because they're just looking at it and they're saying, okay, well, the Fed can't cut because, you know, we've got inflation uncertainty. And it's like, you know, and then they change their mind like 3 months later and they have no idea what they're talking about. And so it's really like obscene. Like it's ridiculous. Like I literally laugh sometimes out loud when I turn on Bloomberg. Like I'm trying now not to spend much time listening to the news because it just gets in the way of my viewpoints. Like Friday, I was like looking at the charts, looking at the markets. We've been in a consolidation zone for like 5 weeks. I'm looking at everything. I'm like, you know what? This is the buying point on Friday. And I'm thinking buy. And then like, you know, the bombing happens and I'm like, oh, maybe I was really stupid buying on Friday. And now I look at my charts and the S&P is up 0.5%, up over 30 points. And I'm like, oh, maybe I wasn't so stupid to be buying call options on SPX, you know, on Friday. So, you know, I try to think, stay in my head and we'll see what happens. I've said in my recent tweets, like, so I basically, last thing I'll add here, though, I was bearish in the beginning of the year. I raised a bunch of cash. I bought puts. I predicted a 15 to 25% decline in the SPY. I got back in April 10th. I made a bunch of posts saying this is buying opportunity of a generation when S&P was 5,100. And I bought a bunch of stuff. And then over the following weeks, I began taking profits on things like options and things. And I had built up a big cash pile. So only for the second time this year have I started to deploy a bunch of cash. And I started on last Friday because of where the charts were at. And, you know, I saved half of it because I was worried about geopolitical mess. And I said, I do think something in the 5,700, 5,800 range on SPY or on SPX is possible. But when I looked at Bitcoin, and Bitcoin over the weekend traded down to 99,000. Guess where that is? When last time Bitcoin was at 99,000, the S&P 500 was around 5,700, 5,800. And so I looked at it and I said, Bitcoin's gotten down to my sell-off level. I'm buying Bitcoin at 99,000. And then I'm still holding cash in case, you know, SPX drops to 5,700, 5,800. But I deployed half of it on Friday, you know. So I just think like people that are trying to measure this economy by the old rules and what they think makes sense are just going to lose out on the opportunity because we're heading into a bubble type situation.
Yeah, and I definitely agree with you, and you've provided some amazing insights. But you said that you're a Duke guy, so now we got to get into a little bit of Duke basketball talk, man, because I always like to pull back the curtain and let people know who's really underneath the hood when it comes to these type of conversations. So now that NIL is super prevalent, you guys have had Cooper Flag and everything else. Do you think Duke's lost their edge because now everybody else can pay their players and nobody when Coach K was around was able to pay except for Duke? Obviously, this is
that Final Four was just brutal, man. I mean, I was so pumped for Duke to win it all again. And Cooper Flag is an amazing player, but I mean, what is he like? 19 years old? I mean, yeah. Like these guys get into these situations, and that's what I love about the NCAA. Like, it's one game, it's not a best of seven series, and they're literally kids, and it's like anything can happen. And no, it was totally exciting. I thought Duke should have won. I think if you'd have had a best of five or a best of seven series, Duke probably would have been your NCAA champion this year. But yeah, you know, Coach K, yeah, you know, in Durham here, yeah, it's a small place. I went to business school with a guy, I won't say his name, but his brother is married to Coach K's daughter. And so there's connections around, and, you know, it's not too far away from me here in Durham. But, you know, I do love Duke basketball, but I'm generally just like a happy guy. Like, hey, Duke loses, they lose. I thought they were going to win, you know, whatever. So it's just fun to watch. I love the NCAA Final Four. I'll tell you one thing, Brandon. I just watch the top things, right? Like, so World Cup, NCAA Final Four, Super Bowl, you know, Wimbledon, French Open. I mean, that was incredible. If you follow any tennis, that Alcaraz match with Sinner in the final, that five, oh my God, man. That guy, Alcaraz, is incredible. Like, I love watching athletes at their highest level just perform in the biggest events. And so I'll give you that as like, I don't know what's coming up here. What's the next big sporting event?
Oh man. I don't even know. Maybe the World Series is probably the next. I mean, we just had the Game 7 of the NBA Finals last night, that as we're recording this here, Monday on the 23rd. So the OKC Thunder won that. So I think that's the next like major sports championship. It's a kind of like a lull period right now, or maybe some golf. But yeah, I can't think of it off the top of my head. I want to hear, do you have a Mount Rushmore of Duke players? Cause I'm curious, cause they've all, obviously you guys have had so many greats come through, but I'm curious.
Well, you have to look at, are you judging them on their Duke performance or overall performance? Like Leitner, was amazing at Duke, disappointing afterwards. Hurley, you know, Grant Hill, you know, I mean, there's been some great ones. So I'd go back to that range because that was when I was really following, Duke a lot more in the '80s, nineties, maybe early 2000s. And then, yeah, I went to Duke in 08 to 2010. And we did win in 2010. We won the championship then. So yeah, I mean, this is just, it's an amazing place here where I live in Durham, North Carolina for college basketball. I mean, you got NC State, Duke, North Carolina. I could drive to any of their stadiums in 20 minutes from where I live. It's the mecca of college basketball. Michael Jordan, I was born in Chicago. I mean, Jordan, you know, coming from Wilmington about 2 hours away, you know, I don't know what it is about North Carolina, but we're pretty damn good at basketball here.
Yeah, 100%. I was born in Chicago as well, so I'm a Bulls fan. Jordan's my
goat. I was technically born in LaGrange.
Okay.
In Cook County. So I wasn't born in the city. I do come from like a third generation, like kind of Chicagoans. Like family came from Norway and Poland to Chicago. Then I have one grandma who moved up to Chicago during the Depression from Tennessee. And she is descended from Davy Crockett. So I'm technically like a
Oh, there we go.
From the Crockett's and I, you know, like, so I have like 25% of my family history goes back to like the 1600s in the United States. And then 75% of it is like Polish, Norwegian, recent ancestry to Chicago. My mom grew up in the back of a butcher shop on the south side of Chicago. My dad, you know, his father died during World War II, and the mom, my grandma was, you know, widowed and kids and stuff. And they have an amazing story. And, you know, it's an amazing American story. So, but what about you from Chicago?
Yeah. Originally from Chicago, you know, I was born in Park Ridge, so Northside suburbs. And then my family moved to Austin, Texas when I was really little. But you sound like the classic, you know, Chicago, and you got the Polish, you know, the Saturday Night Live skit, you know, where he's choking on the Polish sausage and everything.
Oh, like yeah, that, baby. You know? Italian beefs, man. Portillo's Italian beefs are my favorite. My wife still gets on me, Mel, why are you buying hot dogs? Like, I love hot dogs. I'm sorry. I grill out hot dogs. I know it sounds stupid. No, I love hot dogs, Italian beefs, pizzas, all that stuff. Like, the food is what I miss about Chicago. But I, most of my life, I've lived in the South. So, you know, for whatever that's worth. My family was 8 years old. We moved to Virginia and then moved back to Chicago when I was 15. Then after college, I moved to San Diego, lived there for a few years. Then I went to Duke, moved to Seattle, and then moved back to North Carolina like 15 years ago. So if you add up my childhood and recent time, I've probably lived about 25 years in the South, in Virginia, North Carolina. And the other 25 years is spread out between Chicago, Seattle, and San Diego. And, you know, and my wife is from Medellin, and we spent some time down in Colombia. And, you know, I love Latin America. My first business I ever started was an import business from Guatemala, buying hammocks and different típicas. I speak a little Spanish. And so, like, I love going around the world doing different things. I'm really not from anywhere, to be honest with you, after all of that. But, man, I'll tell you, like, this world is crazy. There's been so many incredible opportunities. Bitcoin, probably the greatest opportunity finance-wise in my lifetime. And I think a lot of people, if they let themselves get scared, if they let themselves say, oh, well, you know what? Jobless claims are a little up. But there is some jobless claims, you know, rising. There's a little weakness in the labor market. This is what's going to lead the Fed to cut rates. This is what's going to lead to this asset bubble, is we're going to have a labor recession and not a corporate recession. And so earnings are going to stay. They're going to grow. They're going to reduce headcount. Interest rates are going to go down because Fed is worried about labor market. And then also they need to get interest expense down. And if you look at interest expense, you know, it's about 3% of GDP right now, U.S. interest expense. For 11 years from 1985 to 1996, for 11 years, interest expense was about 3% of GDP. The S&P was up 360% during that time, from like 150 to like 750 or 120 to 750. So we've got a situation that's repeating right now where you've got high interest expense, which is stimulus into the economy. You've got corporate profits strong. You've got a labor market, which is weakening, which is going to lead to lower rates. You've got deflationary impulses that are going to essentially allow the government to maintain fiscal deficits and lower rates. And all of that is a concoction for asset bubble pricing. And I think, you know, despite the noise of Mideast things, we could have some V-shaped 3%, 5%, 7% declines. But in the end of the day, it's up and to the right. And we've got at least one more 2 to 3 year period of a, you know, blow off top type situation. And I'll reassess it later once we get there.
There we go. I love it. Well, Mel, you've been very generous with your time, and thank you for having a little fun with me at the end of this conversation. Why don't you tell people where they can find out more about you and what you got going on?
Yeah. So just Mel Madison One on Twitter, and I've got a website, melmadison.com, and I've got a financial thriller novel called Quaz about corrupt central bankers, blockchain, quantum AI. Those are my three main things. And I'd really appreciate, you know, getting some Twitter followers, because I just started doing it about a year ago. I don't have too many, maybe 10, 11,000, and would love to get a few more Twitter followers, because I think I put out a lot of good, timely stuff. So if people would follow me there, I'd really appreciate it.
Yeah, 100%. I'll put all that in the bio, and I can attest. Go follow Mel on Twitter. And Mel, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you guys all for tuning in to another great episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. If you found some value in this one, please hit that subscribe button and that like button to help send this one to the masses. And I've got a surprise for you guys. I've got two more episodes that you have the chance to watch here. So go ahead and click one of them, and I'll see you guys all at the next one.